The information and ideas discussed in this program are intended to be educational and to motivate listeners to take control of their own financial future. Because the subject matter is complex and situations differ widely between individuals, we strongly recommend that you consult qualified professionals before acting on the information discussed in the program.
Hi, and welcome to Pro Money Talk. I'm Jason.
And I'm Peter.
Well, we have a great show today. We'll be talking about real estate, specifically the housing market. We'll also be talking about commodities. And Peter will be giving a new success story, one in a series of success stories that you will be hearing in future shows.
And the success story this week is related to last week's podcast where Jason did the interview about women handling finances and learning a little bit about them before the man dies. And this is a perfect example of that.
If you'd like to send in your own success story, please go to our website, www.promoneytalk.com. And there you can submit your own success story, or you can also sign up for our email alerts.
You can also send emails directly to us at promoneytalk@gmail.com. And if you'd like to send audio comments, we may include those from time to time. In the future, I'd like to do some phone interviews with people who have success stories as well.
Before we get started, I wanted to talk about a nice investment magazine. It's called Growfolio. You can read Growfolio at www.growfolio.com. Growfolio is the world's first online investment magazine. This issue number 6, is a summer issue, and among other things, they talk about ethical investing and, of course, investment podcasting.
Of course. Everybody's talking about that. The nice thing is that the author only mentions 2 investment podcasts, and we were blessed to be one of them.
That's right, with a highly recommend, so we appreciate that. Now, Peter, we're going to talk about one of the hottest topics today, and that is real estate, specifically the housing market. A lot of people want to know what's going to happen. Are housing prices going to continue to go up? Are they going to go down? Are they going to stay the same? How do I know what to expect?
Right. And, of course, real estate often is thought of in terms of the location where it is. This housing boom really is a global phenomenon. It's not just in the U.S. It's in China. It's in Italy. It's, you know, Asia, Europe, everywhere. All over the world. It hasn't hit all parts of this country, and I'd say those areas that haven't gone up a lot probably won't come down a lot, but it's been driven clearly by liquidity, which means excess currency available that the central banks have kept interest rates low to stimulate economies around the world. That money didn't go into stocks this time, I think because people were still wary of the downturn in stocks that was pretty recent in our memories. So it's probably why it spilled over into housing. The liquidity's other component is low interest rates, and that's really driven this housing market to the point where housing has just risen significantly over the last few years.
Now, you say that it's a global phenomenon, but real estate still has a strong regional focus. In some areas of our country, for instance, have risen more than others, and are maybe some areas are possibly more overextended than other areas.
Yeah, there have been a number of articles recently on the amount of risk in the different areas in the U.S. Sometimes they'll look at the income level in a given area versus housing prices. Sometimes they'll look at the rent level vis-a-vis the purchase price. In all cases, they're trying to get a handle on whether a particular area is overextended and how much risk is in that area. In any case, a lot of parts of the U.S. have risen significantly. L.A., San Diego, Las Vegas, Florida, Boston, New York, Washington, of course, the San Francisco Bay Area more recently as well.
And because of that, we're seeing a lot of speculation in the market. There's a feeling among some people, I think, that real estate's always done well, that real estate will always continue to do well. And a lot of that might be based on the fact that their parents bought a house 30 years ago for a seemingly insignificant amount, and they look at housing prices now.
In fact, you and I had the pleasure of speaking with a financial planner whose father told her, go ahead and buy real estate. It always goes up, especially in California. And the rest of the story was very enlightening because she and her husband, young newlyweds, had purchased a house in Los Angeles area around 1990, right at the peak of their market when it started down. And I believe they sold the house 6 years later. They had put 30% down on it, pretty conservative. 6 years later, they sold the house, and they had to actually put money into it to pay off the debt. So they lost 30% at least on the market value of that property, and it had not recovered after 6 years. So even in beautiful, sunny California, real estate prices don't always go up. And because you only put a small down payment on real estate, generally in the U.S., you've leveraged your position.
So, Peter, can you give us an example of using leverage to purchase a home and how that increases the risk?
Sure. Whenever you invest using leverage, you're borrowing to make the acquisition, and it increases the volatility for you. So let me give you an example in the purchase of a home. Using round numbers, if you were to purchase a $100,000 house with 20% down, your leverage is 5-1. Every percent movement in the price of the house is going to have 5 times greater movement in your investment. So if you bought a house for $100,000, you borrowed $80,000, your investment is $20,000. The house goes down, let's say 10%. Your investment has gone down 50%. Because at that point, if you sold the house for $90,000 and you pay off the bank the $80,000, you only have $10,000 left. So you've lost half of your investment.
So you started off with $20,000 and you end up with $10,000.
Right. So you're magnifying the price movements in your own investment. And that's a way that some people have gotten rich when markets move in their favor. If it went up 20%, you'd double your money. If it went down 20%, you'd lose all of your investment. So you're magnifying the risk, much as a lever would magnify movement.
So it's important for people to understand then that the same reasons people make a lot of money in real estate are the reasons that people can lose a lot of money in real estate, and that people, in fact, in the not-too-distant past, have lost quite a bit of money in real estate.
Right. We've talked about how housing markets don't always go up. Sometimes they actually go down.
Sometimes they go down, sometimes they go sideways, perhaps for a long period of time, and of course, sometimes they go up as they have. Well, I guess the question on everyone's mind is this a bubble or has the housing market peaked? And in order to determine that, we look at concrete data. Can you share with us how we can tell if a housing market has peaked?
When we're in the middle of investment markets, we're never sure where they're going next. You know, we have to be a little bit humble about that. But there are several things that point to a possible peak in the housing market. We've certainly seen prices rise very quickly. And with given the amount of rise that they've had and the velocity or the percentage increases being so large, they're not likely to continue on that vein for a very long time. So that's one indicator. They've risen way above their historical average. Another indicator is that the things that drove that market, which were low interest rates and easy money, could start to dry up, and we're already seeing rising short-term rates. If we see rising long-term rates as well, then all kinds of mortgages would become more expensive. So for the same price of a house, the actual cost in terms of dollars that the investor or home buyer would have to shell out would rise. Some things change and begin to give signals that prices might decline in the future. So even though reports of lower prices in housing in the U.S. are few and far between, most markets are still rising or they're holding their own, there are some early warning signs that I'm thinking of how people would like to be able to predict earthquakes and so on, that you can predict the weather to some extent. But so some of the indicators that people would see early on would be things like how long a home is actually on the market. In a hot market, homes sell very quickly. But as buyers dry up, as there are fewer buyers, then it takes longer to get a home off the market. So inventory could also rise if more homes are coming on the market. So one indicator is how long does it take the average house to sell in a given market. Recently in Boston, it's taken 46 days to sell a house, whereas a year ago it was 39 days. But in Providence, Rhode Island, the gap is even greater. Now the average house sits on the market for 65 days before sale, and a year ago that was only 14 days. So the time on the market is definitely one of the indicators that would show that a housing market is weakening.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously when houses sit on the market longer, there's a chance that the inventory will rise. So the number of homes for sale may be going up right before prices would decline.
What are other indicators, Peter, that the housing market may have peaked?
Another indicator is market activity. How many homes are sold in a given period compared to the period before? That's the earliest indicator, but it's often gives false positives that sales may dip in a given month. But because the number is small, it's hard to draw inferences from it.
Mm-hmm.
Other people, when they're looking for a bubble, they're trying to gauge the amount of risk and whether the housing market is out of whack. And when you say, is it out of whack, it's compared to what? Not only prices in other parts of the country, but the differential between the price of buying a home versus renting a home. That when there's a big spread there, some people are going to say, gee, it would be a lot less expensive for me to rent, let's say.
I consider this a really significant indicator. So let's talk a little bit more in depth about that. Give me an example of what you're talking about here.
Well, right now in the U.S., we've got the highest rate of home ownership that we've ever had in history. Because of the low interest rates, the easy credit, more people have bought homes and they've left the apartments. Apartment vacancies are pretty high. So landlords have had to lower rent to entice renters. So, for example, in San Diego, there's a condo development called Park Place, where a one-bedroom condo sells for $719,000. The monthly payments on that would be about $3,775 a month, whereas if you were to rent one of those units, you could rent it for $2,400 a month. So even after tax savings and so on, you'd probably be better off renting that.
Yeah, and where we live in the San Francisco Bay Area, we have one of those hot home markets, and it's even more pronounced in an area that I just moved to. They're selling in the $700,000 range, and you can actually rent it for $1,500 a month. So there's a huge disparity between the monthly cost of paying a mortgage and the rents.
You figure sooner or later that's going to come back into a more normal relationship.
So home prices, in that scenario, home prices could go down, meaning mortgages go down. Rent prices could go up, meaning, you know, that it's getting closer. Or mortgage prices could go down and rent prices could come up to sort of meet in the middle somewhere.
Yeah, we look at historical relationships between different asset classes as investors, and we look for those kinds of relationships that something sells for, say, 20% more than something else, or it yields 3% more because it has more risk. And it's been a pretty good tool for us when those relationships get out of whack to their history, that it has some predictive value, that things are going to come back into that. They're going to revert to the mean, we call it, or get back to their normal relationship to each other. Jason, you were talking about home prices could stay where they are and the fundamentals could improve.
What I was mentioning was that even if we consider home prices to be overvalued, not necessarily an indicator that the prices for sure will drop, the price could stay the same over a period of years. And due to inflation and the rising of other assets, the mean could catch up with that asset. It could be a leveling. It could be a small increase. But what we are saying is that historically things work towards their mean, and right now it's overvalued. And there is an opportunity cost for investing in something. So if something is overvalued, even if it does stay flat, we could have been investing in something else that was increasing. So there is a cost to investing in an asset, even if that asset doesn't go down.
Right. That can be considered a loss. Some of the other factors that might presage a decline in home prices is the number of houses that fail to sell. It's hard to get a handle on this number. I think real estate agents have a sense of this, but houses are taken off the market if they don't sell. And so you don't see the failures. You only see the ones that are selling. The longer in a slower housing market, obviously the houses are on the market longer, that number would be higher if the houses that failed to sell stayed on the market. But if real estate agents are taking those homes off the market, then the time on the market may be a bit misleading. But eventually, the average time of houses on the market is going to stretch, and it will be a clear signal of a cooling market. So we may not see the prices move right away, but we might see some of these other indicators that there's at least weakness, whether that means a decline or just a leveling off. So one other indicator is the loan quality. Obviously, what supports a housing market bubble is easy money. And it turns out that not only have interest rates been low, but lots of lenders have been willing to lend money to home buyers. And that's been exacerbated in recent years because the markets are no longer a single lender to a single borrower. It's not just the local bank anymore. The local bank will lend the money and turn around and sell that asset, that loan, to sometimes a quasi-governmental agency like Fannie Mae or Ginnie Mae. Sometimes it's private mortgage pools. But there are lots of people willing to put money up to buy these kinds of assets, which means lots of money sloshing around, and it's available. And the quality, the requirements for the borrowers has been slipping. So with all this money looking for a place to land, the lenders are saying, gosh, we got to put this money to work, and we'll make it, we'll take people with below average credit scores, we'll take no doc loans. I think that number has been rising. So the quality of the loan market is declining, and you tend to see that at the end of bubbles also.
People are willing to now do the lower quality loans that they weren't willing to do perhaps before.
It makes for a more fragile market. All of these things that have driven home prices up, the easy money, the low interest rates, those are the same factors when they turn around that'll drive housing prices down.
Good.
So if you start to get some weak players, when they have to bail out, let's say they're stretched to the limit to do an interest-only loan, if the rates rise and they can't make the payments, they have to sell the house, and you see more houses coming on the market, and more supply with the same amount of demand, you get lower prices ultimately.
Okay. Now, before we wrap this segment up, I'd like to mention one more thing, and that is that when you talk to real estate agents, they talk about the two components of a home purchase. One is price and the other is terms. Now, when we're looking at the real estate market, for some reason, we seem to focus on price. Are the prices increasing? Are the prices leveling off? But terms are very important. Currently, and in the recent past, we've had terms like 15-day closings. We've had terms like as-is sales. All these things are very favorable to the seller. One of the things that I expect to see before prices go down are that terms are going to start to become less favorable to the seller and get to a more traditional level, meaning that you'll likely see fewer multiple offers on a home and that the seller may still sell the home for the same prices as they could have the month before, but now they may be required to pay $10,000 for the pest abatement, or they may be required to spend $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 on improvements or fixes on the homes, whereas in the current market they're not expected to do so.
So really, in finance, we talk about the terms. The price is actually going up for the seller at that point because he either has to put more of his money into the deal beforehand or he has to take time and do things. So all of these are indicators of market activity, and they're indicators of supply and demand. They're indicators of availability of money to borrow. And frankly, I think we've seen the peak in the market probably this summer.
Give us a takeaway from this. Give us one or two takeaways from this.
I think that you got to look a little deeper than just prices.
Okay.
Same problem people ran into with stocks. Prices were going up, up, up. They said, this is the recent history. I expect that to keep going. That's human nature to expect trends to continue. But you got to look behind the scenes, do a little bit of digging, a little bit of homework, and you begin to see that maybe the foundation is a little bit rotten, that there might be some cracks forming. The second takeaway is that by the time The economists know that the market's slowing. It's been underway for quite a while because first, all these factors have to start to weaken. Then prices drop. Then the data is gathered. Then the data is published. You're going to hear about it. It's going to be historical. And what's actually happening now won't be reflected in the major news outlets or in the government numbers for some time to come. Also want to emphasize that if you're going to buy a house at this point with prices relatively high, whether they're in a bubble or not, I wouldn't do it if I were going to turn around and sell that house within the next few years.
And in fact, we're telling clients that if they have real estate that they're thinking about selling within the next couple of years, now's probably a pretty good time to do it.
Yeah, we never know where the top is.
That's right.
But we know prices have risen, and we have another saying on Wall Street, bulls make money and bears make money, but pigs get slaughtered. So trying to time the market and be perfect is a dangerous game, and we should sometimes just be satisfied that we have a nice profit and walk away.
That's a great lesson. Now, real estate's been hot for the last several years, and people who hadn't invested in real estate or had invested in real estate maybe in a long time are starting to look at real estate again. And it seems that every now and then something comes up that people have forgotten about, or there hasn't been a spotlight on it for a while. And then it comes back into our public conscience, and people see it again for the first time, if you will, and start investing. One of the things that hasn't had a lot of popular investing are commodities. If you're unfamiliar with commodities, make sure to go back to our show on diversification where we introduce commodities. But commodities are something that in the financial planning world have begun to be talked about. And therefore, I expect that the public will start to hear about it, well, within the next couple of years. So let's talk about commodities and educate our listeners on potentially a new asset class that they haven't thought about investing in.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that things go in phases and people focus on one thing and that goes for a while and then they lose interest or they get burned and they pull in their horns and say, I'm never doing that again. And then the next thing you know, they're going after the next hot craze. Commodities may be that next craze. It's hard to say, but we're talking about something that's fundamentally different than traditional investments. Traditional investments are stocks and bonds, pretty much, sometimes cash or money market funds. A commodity is fundamentally different in that it's a thing. It's a tangible thing, whether it's oil, whether it's some kind of food stuff, whether it's a physical metal that's used in manufacturing. Commodities are stuff. They're things. And from time to time, they go through shortages and their prices rise. Also, if a currency weakens, if we have high rates of inflation, that means the currency is losing its value, then people are inclined to hold things. If you are watching the price of gasoline or whatever kind of commodity it is, if you know that the price is going to be rising very quickly, whatever the market is, people tend to rush in and buy it and stock up on it because they know that it's going to be more expensive tomorrow. So commodities are a great inflation hedge, and people have invested in them all along. There are always people that I find in the investment business, the gold bugs, the people who always are intrigued by the glitter of gold. And gold is the classical commodity that will hold its value through disastrous times and protect you against the falling dollar and so on.
You might want to mention the fallacy of that.
Yeah, if you bought gold in 1980, you would have a loss still 25 years later. But commodities can play a role in a portfolio, and they can provide a very useful diversification role.
So you mentioned that commodities are a hedge against inflation.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a strong supply and demand aspect to commodities. When we talk about commodities, as Peter said, we're talking about the wide range of commodities here, not just energy, which we've seen a big rise in lately, but a lot of the building blocks of civilization, if you will, of our modern civilization, steel, aluminum, wood, foodstuffs, as you mentioned, the classic pork bellies and grains. So one of the arguments for commodities has been that demand is increasing at a higher rate. Explain to us about that and why demand would be increasing at this point in history.
I think the primary reason at this point is that there's been a global boom, economic boom going on. We've seen that evidenced in China, a lot of talk about China. China's now the number two oil-using country in the world. They're using tremendous amounts of steel and raw materials to build buildings, and they're ramping up their production. They're growing at 8% a year. So that means that every 9 years, their economy is doubling in output.
That's amazing.
It really is, because here we're very happy if we get 3.5% or 4% growth in a year. They're coming from a lower base, but with as many people as they have, it has a huge impact on commodities around the world. Well, also there's constraints in production. There's a lag time between the demand for commodities and when they can actually be produced. So, for instance, the price of oil is higher, but think about how long it takes to drag the old oil drilling rigs out of mothballs and put them out into the field and train the people to use them. For a while, we didn't seem to need that. If you have a shortage in the industrial metals, the nickel and the copper and so on, you don't just decide one day that you're going to double your output of those. It takes years to ramp that up. So there can be imbalances of supply and demand, as well as fundamental currency inflation that makes things more valuable than anything denominated in currency.
And I'd like to mention that a lot of research has been done that it's not only the usual or the most visible suspects, if you will, China and India, but also that the developing nations in South America are using quite a bit of natural resources now, particularly Brazil. But let's move on. How are people going to take advantage of this situation?
No, there's the traditional approach of just owning valuable things. So some people would go out and they'd buy precious metal in bullion or in coins, maybe keep some at home, bury it in the backyard. So people sometimes buy the stuff themselves and hold it. It doesn't earn dividends. You're expecting that it's going to go up in value, and you're expecting that there's going to be a liquid and fair market with low transaction costs and so on. So there are a lot of considerations. One popular mutual fund manager that we follow and use bought a lot of industrial metals and put them in a warehouse in Minneapolis and has done well with that investment. Some people are trying to get involved in commodities through natural resource mutual funds, which gives you some access to companies that own or have reserves or inventories of, say, land or oil and gas and that kind of thing. But it's not a pure play on the commodities. It's actually a business investment. And it depends on how well-structured the businesses are and whether they have a lot of debt and whether they're paying a lot in taxes. There are a lot of other factors that go into the movements of price for stocks of companies that own commodities.
So, Peter, I don't want to buy a company that owns commodities or a company that specializes in commodities. And frankly, I don't have the resources to fill up a warehouse with steel or aluminum. Now what? What are my options?
A development that's come about in the last couple of years is some mutual funds that are offering exposure to commodities. And that, I think, has some real advantages to it. Obviously, you don't have to store the materials. You're not involved in the futures market. Now, obviously, that was a way that a lot of people took, and that's why commodities have a bad name in a lot of households. In the futures market, you'd put 2% down, and you'd have to close out your contract within 2 or 3 months whenever it expired. That kind of leverage we don't need, because a 2% move could wipe you out in a day.
So let me just interject here for a second. Peter's talking about buying futures and commodities. You're not actually buying the commodity. You're buying the option to buy the commodity at a certain price or sell the commodity at a certain price at a later date. It adds a tremendous amount of leverage and a tremendous amount of risk, therefore.
Yeah, futures are a special kind of a market with a lot of turnover, very high transaction and commission costs, and that leverage and that lack of diversification. You have a lot of problems with futures. The mutual fund approach that we just started to touch on aims to fix some of those problems and give people exposure to commodities in sort of a safe and sane way by diversifying the holdings, and they do that through owning indexes of commodities. So they'll get a variety of commodity holdings. Secondly, they don't employ leverage. So what we're talking about is diversification, deleveraging, and having a liquid investment that you don't have to own or take possession of or store.
This is an area that a lot of investors haven't dabbled in. And in fact, up until recently, that's probably wise. It was an area that was, because it was traded typically using futures, it was an area of a lot of risk. But now people, the common person, if you will, is having entree to this market of commodities. They're able to invest using mutual funds. They're able to diversify. They're able to deleverage. And so really investors are getting access to this market, or the average investor is getting access to this market in a way that he's never had access before.
The new vehicles, being able to buy it in a sensible way through a liquid mutual fund, makes it accessible and makes it something that we are recommending to our clients at this point.
But it's certainly not something that in our practice we're going to bet the farm on.
No, we've started out with approximately 5% in client portfolios. And not every client wants to own them, some want to own a little bit more. But we're taking a modest position. We'll use judgment when the economy starts to turn down and the demand for goods starts to taper off. This may not be an investment that we want to hold all the time. But certainly when it looks like we're getting towards the end of an expansion, or it's been going on for some time, there's more demand for these kinds of goods. It's a nice hedge against the possibility of a falling dollar in currency markets. It's a nice hedge against countries like China evolving and using more resources and driving up the prices here.
So, Peter, tell me what type of person this would not make sense for. What type of person should really maybe not look at investing in commodities?
Well, I think if your outlook is for a recession or a depression, or a person who's worried about maybe a terrorist attack, that person might want to stay away from things that would do well in a hot economy and move toward things that would do well in a cooling economy like bonds.
So a lot has to do with the outlook on where you think the economy is going. What about things like volatility? How do commodities behave?
Well, I don't think it would be unusual to see movements up or down of 20 or 30% in a year, even on the indexes. It's still pretty volatile, even though it's deleveraged and even though it's diversified. The fund that we use invests in an index that limits the exposure to oil and gas to about 30% and holds 16 to 20 different commodities. The index that it uses is the Dow Jones AIG Commodity Index. But even with all of that, it's still fairly volatile. So if a person doesn't like volatility, certainly this would not suit them.
And maybe if they had money to put away that they need in a pretty short time frame, this would not be a good investment for them.
Correct. If you need money soon, money markets are a good place. While we're not recommending it, it's a significant area. It may be a good companion in a portfolio along with the cash equivalents, the bonds, the stocks, the real estate. It gives us another area to look at, and we've talked about the value of the diversification in reducing risk. These types of investments would have, I think, zero correlation or perhaps a negative correlation with stocks and bonds. So it's ideal from our standpoint of reducing risk in the overall portfolio.
So commodities, or topics that we discuss on the show, are things that we think may be of interest to our listener. We're hoping to expose people to concepts and ideas, and if we can expose them to new opportunities before maybe they hear about them in other places, we're hoping to provide value that way.
We really, really emphasize that investing should be tailored to the individual circumstances and temperament, and we're giving sort of general insights that hopefully will help you understand, and if you're not doing it yourself, to even work better with your professional.
As we've mentioned in past shows, from time to time we're going to have a segment on success stories. And Peter has a success story for us this week that dovetails with the show that we did last week on financial intimacy.
Jason interviewed Helga Hayes last week, who talked about the importance of spouses knowing what's going on with money in the family, as in her case, when her husband died unexpectedly, she was left holding the bag, not only having to deal with the grief and the changes in lifestyle, but also having to figure out the pieces and put them together. And it's not easy, even in the best of times. So at the worst of times, it's very anxiety-provoking, and believe me, you just don't have the energy. Any of you that have been through the death of a loved one, you just don't have the energy at that point in time to take on big projects. So really that knowledge and having a handle on things, that's why we're doing this show, is because most people don't know much about money, and there's a lot to learn. So Helga emphasizes, she has seminars where she just has women, and I remember the story at the end where one woman in particular had been irritated that her husband was always trying to get her to participate. And she came to understand that he was actually doing it. It was an act of love, and he was doing her a favor in trying to educate her about money. And in this week's success story, we're talking about one of our clients. The names have been changed to protect the innocent. And we're talking about just such a case where a wife took some initiative to learn about the family finances and get them on track. And as it turned out, it was a good thing that she did. So we're going to talk about Mary and Ed. Ed was a dentist, and Mary was just a homemaker. Ed's plan was to die in the saddle. He was just going to keep working and working, and they never really saved a lot of money. They didn't have a lot of insurance, life insurance or disability, and Mary was a little uneasy with that. So it turned out that he did die at a relatively young age. But before he died, she signed up for a financial planning seminar at a junior college and began to learn about handling money. And I'm going to read a little bit, and I'm going to quote from what Mary told me. Ed never talked to Mary about their savings. He handled all the money, only giving Mary a check once a month to pay the bills. She said it wasn't enough to save very much except to set aside funds for likely expenses such as appliances. Ed ran all the finances. And even though Mary signed the tax return, she didn't know how much they made or how much was in the office account that Ed had. They did have trusts, and he had inherited a little bit of money from his aunt, actually the same year he died. And she had inherited a little bit from her mother several years before, but her mother's estate was small enough that she really didn't need any help in handling that money. When she took the course, it was at a junior college. The textbook was Personal Money Management by Baylard Beal and Kaiser, which was, I think, the first fee-only financial planning firm in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they had a pretty large company, 20, 30, 40 people there at the company. So that was the handbook that was used, the textbook. The teacher of the class was a vice president of Bank of America. So this was in the late 1970s, and Mary found the course very useful and informative. It was about setting goals and planning and making investments. So after she took the course and she was impressed by this company that had written the book, Baylard Beal and Kaiser, so she talked her husband into going over there to get a financial plan. She thought if they went to a meeting that he might be more willing to listen and take some action, because she saw that they really weren't saving or planning for retirement. She said it was nerve-wracking the day they went to the appointment because he didn't want to go. But he did wind up going, and he was surprised how short they were. They said, you're going to have to work for a long time, and obviously that was what he sort of had in mind. They had a young woman who met with them to explain the plan, and she said that wasn't good at all because her husband didn't want to hear about finances from a woman. But the woman that they worked with was very sharp, and her husband was 63 at the time. They had a net worth of $379,000. The dental practice was worth about $100,000, and they had investments of about $90,000 at that point. I don't know what that would be in today's dollars, but we're talking maybe three times that much in today's dollars. So he would have had to work to age 70 at least. I'm not sure at what point, but he contracted hepatitis and probably got it from a patient, you know, blood-borne disease. and he had to work up until about 2 weeks before he died. He did take a couple of months off the previous summer, but he didn't have any disability insurance to cover him while he wasn't working, so he had to go back to work. When he died, Mary hired Bayard, Beal & Kaiser to handle their stuff, and they made investments for her, and they took care of her pretty much. There were some attorneys involved, you know, tax preparer and so on. She thought her counselor was a very nice person, very bright. She gave seminars for the company, so she was very impressed. The only life insurance was Ed's veterans life insurance policy, and the financial planning company thought she might have to sell their house or reduce living expenses to make ends meet. The life insurance was only about $27,000, but luckily the practice value covered the shortfall. But as she put it, when her advisor took over, she didn't have to worry. They met quite often, and this was a big shift for Mary because she had to handle financial details and she wasn't used to that. The plan that they had done provided the needed information, though, to get a head start. So the fact she started early was very valuable, and she'd already begun to make these contacts that would be useful, and she already had something of an idea of what they would need for retirement. But she took the bull by the horn. She took the initiative, even when it meant sort of rubbing her husband the wrong way while he was still alive. The financial planning firm recommended that she get an estate plan done. She didn't like the first attorney. He was an expert at things, but he wasn't very good with people. So she eventually chose an estate planning attorney in Palo Alto. And later, when Bayard, Beal & Kaiser raised their minimum account size beyond the size of her account, she asked that attorney for a recommendation, and that's when Mary came to us. And I believe I met with her, it was still in the 1980s when I met with her. She says things went relatively smoothly all along, that the financial planners have been very helpful. If she had it to do over, she says she wouldn't do anything differently. Her goal is to have enough money to live on until she leaves this earth. And we've run her plan a number of times and have found that she has enough in her nest egg now to last her to age 100 and possibly beyond. She still has worries. I guess we all do. She doesn't feel like she has a lot of money because a lot is tied up in some of the trusts that were set up, and a lot of her net worth is in the house that she lives in. Just to bring our listeners up to date, she is in her mid-80s and is very active. She still travels. She still drives. She's sharp. We enjoy working with her. She still has a little bit of concern about whether her investments can support her, and we do our best to try to show her the ways that that'll happen. She also had an adult daughter who moved back in with her in her 40s because she became disabled. But the daughter is living off of money from a condo that she owns. And so things are really right on track for Mary. And it's gratifying to see that, but she wouldn't have had much to work with, and neither would we, if she hadn't taken the initiative and gotten things started. Another quote from her is, "If you don't have any training, like college courses, you need a planner or a book to read."
Well, that's pretty good advice.
Yeah, so her hard work has paid off, and she's okay, but I don't think she would have been at all if she'd left it up to her husband. So this was a case where she not only had to learn, but she had to fix a few things that were broken.
Well, that's a great success story, very touching and heartwarming, maybe especially to us because we know her, and she's such a great lady. For those people out there who may be thinking that this sort of situation applies to them, we urge you again to listen to our last show, where Helga gives some suggestions about maybe how to approach your partner and break down that barrier and get them to talk about money with you.
Next week, we're going to get back to the interview format, and we have the author of one of the few books that's out there to help people who have stock options at work know how to deal with them. That's an area where a lot of people got tripped up in the tech boom. And even though there are fewer people these days that have stock options at work, it's still a major source of compensation for many, and a lot of people have them outstanding. We're going to have Pete Wheeler on the show, and he is the author of Stock Options and Grants, an executive's guide to equity compensation.
That's right, and it's actually a great book. When I'm working with clients, I'll give it to them, or I'll use it myself to look up questions. It's written in a question and answer type format, so that'll be a fun show next week. Well, once again, to get more information on this show or to submit your own success story, please go to www.promoneytalk.com. There you'll also be able to sign up for our email alert, where we'll send you emails every week letting you know when the show's available and what the topics are. Thank you for listening, and have a nice week.
Have a great week.